This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week are Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
And a returning guest is Sean Malloy.
Hey, what's up, guys? Thank you for apparently not being turned off my first appearance that you accepted me back. So thank you.
Yeah, not at all, not at all. So just as a recap, Sean, he runs the Dolph Lundgren podcast, I Must Make This Podcast. How's that going for you, Sean? What film of Dolph's have you covered lately?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's see. Richard joined me for The Package, which episode came out a few weeks ago, about a month ago or so. I'm not as prolific with you as you guys are with my episodes. I'm lucky if I can get about two out a month or so. But let's see. The Package was released. The most recent episode was I was able to speak with William Stout, who was the production designer on Masters of the Universe. So that episode is out there. I recorded Expendables 2 a couple weeks back. So that one will be dropping here in about the next week or so. And I have a very exciting interview scheduled tomorrow. I don't want to say too much yet because it hasn't happened, but Richard knows who it is. And I think you guys will be very, very pleased once it goes live. That's all I'll say.
You tease you. Okay. Brill. So Sean is joining us to talk about our DTV throwback, which is going to be a film called Shade, which you'll be hearing about later in the show. But before we get to that, we'll have reviews of The Birthday Cake, Black Medicine, Alone, Blood Brothers, and Trigger Point. And our short shot this week is going to be a Mandalorian fan film called The Hunting. So without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is The Birthday Cake. For the past 10 years since the death of his father, Giovanni is tasked with taking a cake to his uncle Angelo's birthday party. This year, however, things are going to turn out different for everyone, and Gio might find out the truth about how and why his father died. Now, when I was watching this, guys, there was one phrase that kept going through my head.
Forget about it.
No.
Yeah.
Has anyone seen Richie? Anyone know why he did... Bobby Lupo! That's all I can think of. I could imagine this film going on in the background of Out for Justice. That's what it reminded me of. Steve, over to you, mate. What did you make of The Birthday Cake?
I really don't know. It was just such a mess. It was all over the place. And it reminded me of like After Hours crossed with The Godfather or something. It was just... I just didn't get it. I'm still not 100% sure what was supposed to have gone on, because it's basically a guy taking a cake to a party. And that is literally it. But he keeps stopping off here, stopping off there. They're looking for his cousin, who's just come out of prison and gone missing because of a drug deal gone wrong. And he's kind of like the only one who knows where he is, but even he doesn't know where he is. And then you get to the end and it just goes batshit again. You've got Ewan McGregor showing up for, 2 minutes and doing a little bit of voiceover. I mean, the cast is quite good, to be fair. You've got Penn Bagley in there as well. And Al Kilmer, which is very interesting because he's obviously had throat cancer and everything.
Yeah.
And he's you know, using his, is it tracheotomy?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I thought it was great. That worked really well, but it's all over the place. You just don't get it. I mean, Lewis Guzman's showing up for 2 minutes in a taxi as well.
Yeah, that was crazy.
You know, and it's like, just playing a stoner, but then the cake gets left. I couldn't. I really don't know. I didn't really enjoy it, but I couldn't explain what was going on or what was happening.
Rich, how did this one take you?
I quite liked it, but it was very, you know, it wore its Martin Scorsese influences on its sleeve.
Yeah.
It couldn't have been more Martin Scorsese if it tried. I mean, the nods to Goodfellas with the casting of Lorraine Bracco and Paul Sorvino, as well as obviously the kind of musical selections that you would expect from a Scorsese movie. There are also nods to the Sopranos as well, which that Lorraine Bracco also did, but Vincent Pastore from that series is in here as well. So if you like, you know, if you like Scorsese gangster movies, I think it's worth a watch. And also the Val Kilmer thing is really interesting because we've seen him in a couple of things. We watched him in Pay Dirt, where he was dubbed, I think. And, yeah, you know, then you watch this and it's like, well, now I know why he's dubbed. And yeah, you're like, and I was thinking, is that really, because I haven't heard him. I've seen him in performances where he's been dubbed and whatnot or been silent, but I've not heard him. And coincidentally, on the day that I watched this on my Twitter, it came up a trailer for a documentary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Called Val, which is going to be coming out very soon. And so I watched the trailer, and his voice in the trailer sounds exactly the same as it does in the movie. So I was like, wow. So that, because literally in the movie, you cannot really understand what he's saying. It's really, really difficult to tune in to his, you know, quote unquote voice, because, you know, he's got to use this, like you say, or voice box thing, and just, I can't even remember what they call it, but, you know, it's really difficult for him to speak. But obviously everyone understands him because they've all been around him, and he's this well-known, well-respected gangster figure. And I think is he the lead character's uncle?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's Uncle Angelo. Yeah.
Uncle Angelo, that's it. So he's like this, he's the godfather figure, basically. Mm. So this is Val Kilmer doing Marlon Brando in The Godfather, in a way. But I like that. I thought that was interesting. I thought that played quite, gave it an interesting dimension. The Ewan McGregor thing was curious. I'm always a bit unsure about Ewan McGregor. I'm not a massive fan, and he doesn't often fit in the things that he's in. And I didn't think necessarily he fitted in this. The main character here is a young guy called Gio, played by Shiloh Fernandez. He did quite well. He's quite amiable. You know, it's a kind of a coming of age kind of story for him. William Fichtner is in there as a really psychotic, dirty cop kind of character. There's a few good people, but yeah, it's a film that meanders, and, you know, it doesn't have. And I wasn't quite sure on exactly what was what at the end, because I felt like it kind of led to a point and then didn't really bother to actually explain anything.
Yeah. It comes to a point where you get sort of a character telling him sort of like, and, you know, now you're a man, it's time to, you learnt the truth about what happened to your father, and then they don't tell us.
I think they would call it an enigmatic conclusion. Yeah.
Obviously for his ears only, you know, not the audience's, you know, who's gone on this journey with him, but there you go.
I also think the film sets up a lot of red herrings. You know, so, like, you think it's about something, but actually it's not.
You got the Russians, you're expecting the Russians to come in at some point, and then you got the Cuban guys who take out one of the main characters. And you think they're going to have a more important role, and they just sort of disappear back into the background. It's very strange. I'll tell you another film which this reminded me of, even though that this is like not a crime film at all. It was an old film with Joe Mantegna called Queen's Logic, which was set in Queens, obviously. It's just about all these sort of 30-somethings getting together for a bachelor party sort of thing, and that was a weird film. And it has that sort of same sort of Shaggy Dog meandering style that this does. You know, If Gio had gotten a cab to his Uncle Angelo's, you know, this would have been a much shorter film and you'd have had a lot less hassle on the way. And the camera sometimes, you know, it segues, like he, you know, he goes to see his friend or his other cousin who works in a diner or a cake shop or something.
Yeah, bakery.
That's at the bakery. And, you know, he gets out of a cab. And then we just carry on in the cab because Louis Guzman's driving it, obviously. So, you know, we get the this whole argument with you know, this couple in the back of the cab and him sort of interjecting,
not really going anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
That part of the story doesn't really go. It reminded. I'll tell you what. Another film that that reminded me of was a recent release called. It was originally known as Feast of the Seven Fishes. But it came out as Evolutionary Pictures released it as a Christmas Feast.
All right.
And that is about a young guy coming of age, Italian family, Christmas. You know, there's all the older guys, and you know, there's some gangs. You know, I think Joey Pants is like a gangster member of the family and stuff. Yeah. And you know, it's just kind of meanders around. You know, with these leading up to you know, this Feast of the Seven Fishes, this family Christmas meal and stuff, and him, you know, a little bit of romance and stuff, which this film also sort of does touch on. It kind of goes in the, oh, is there going to be a little bit of romance? No, actually, no, we're not going to do that either. And so it's constantly introducing all these things and then going somewhere else, which is a bit weird. But I didn't dislike it for that. I mean, I was engaged by it and I was interested and I enjoyed it. It knocks a point off, but apart, you know, I do think it's, if you, especially if you're interested in Scorsese movies and that kind of gangster movie, I think it's worth a watch.
I was quite surprised. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but for some reason I got it into my head this is going to be a Cockney gangster movie.
Yeah, I did as well. I think it was the Ewan McGregor being in it thing.
Yeah.
And the name of it as well.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Birthday cake. I mean, it's such a bizarre thing. But I did like it. You know, I like the sort of the tension that starts building up. You know, when he goes to the house and there's no women around, he's like, "Hey, what's going on here?" sort of thing. And you know, and people are sort of pressing him if he's been talking to the feds, and he's sort of going, "No, of course not." And there's all this sort of stuff going on, and then the thing happens, and I was like, "Holy shit!" You know, it's quite a surprising moment. But you know,
I thought the thing was good. I thought it was well handled.
I thought that was really well done. And
but again, it doesn't lead to anything at the end. I don't know. It's so inconclusive. It wound me up a bit, to be fair.
Yeah, you know? it just showed that Gio was always a patsy. You know, even to his own family, he's a patsy basically. You know, just kind of weird. But I like that bit where sort of like, Ewan McGregor's going, thank you for you know, staying here and painting the church, as he sort of like wipes paint on his hands, you know, just in case. I thought that was actually quite a cool little moment. But this is you know, it's quite a surprise. It's, you know, we've said it's not particularly well structured. Exactly, you might spend a lot of time wondering when the hell he's going to get to this birthday party. You know, the cake will be stale by the time he gets there, the way he's going. You know, the poor thing gets, you know, gets tossed around, gets left in a cab and all the rest of it. You can imagine him unwrapping it at this birthday party and it's just squidged to bits. It's like, oh, sorry. But no. Okay, any more for this one?
No, scores on doors, I think.
Okay, I'll kick off with a 7 out of 10 for this.
I'll go 6.
Mm-hmm. And Rich?
I'm going to go 6 as well.
Oh, God, I may have overstepped. Okay, 2 6s and a 7 for The Birthday Cake. Go check it out. Our next review is Black Medicine. Joe is an anaesthetist who's been struck off and is now working on the black market, patching up local gangsters when they get wounded and assisting with backstreet abortions. Her skills bring her to the attention of Bernadette, the matriarch of the most notorious crime family in Belfast, and given an offer which puts her in a severe moral dilemma. This was a nice surprise. really, really interestingly shot, you know, especially the opening in the car park. You just don't know where it's going. Then we find out what her skills are, you know, what her job is, shall we say, and how professional she is. And we're off and running. And it's an interesting, you know, it's interesting to have a film set in Northern Ireland, which has got nothing to do with the IRA, you know, but it is sort of dealing with a criminal underworld. And, you know, the woman playing Bernadette is fucking ferocious. I really, really enjoyed this. Steve, what do you make of it?
Yeah, no, I did as well, actually. Like you say, you don't know where it's going, or you've got that slight opening where, you know, she's clearly suicidal and comes down and, you know, starts patching people up and stuff. And then you get this twist. Not a twist, but, you know, it just changes direction completely. And she's, you know, tries starting seeing the good in something that she can do and help somebody. But it's one that reminds me of, like, you know, Gone Baby Gone, what would you do in that situation type thing?
Yeah.
You know, if you had the money, would you do that? Would you do what the matriarch is trying to do? And that was fascinating to me. The only thing, I thought the ending was dragged out a bit too much. You could have cut that down a little bit. Not 5-10 minutes off. But apart from that, I enjoyed it. And also, the way it was shot, it kind of reminded me of The Fall as well.
Oh, yeah. You know,
that kind of situation and lighting and all that kind of stuff. But no, it was completely out of the dark, out of the blue, and enjoyable.
Rich?
Yeah, I agree. Very pleasant surprise. Didn't know anything about it. Didn't know what to expect from it. It spins a tale that touches on very familiar themes. It's a maternal thriller, basically. It's a female driven film, and as in the case of quite a few of these, it's about the relationship to a child or a substitute child. And the lead character here, who's suicidal, she ends up in a position where she has some response. You know, she has to make an ethical choice, basically, about, you know, whether she's willing to help somebody who's, you know, in a vulnerable position, but is perhaps not in her best interest to do so. But not in an action way, you know. It's not like Ultraviolet with Milijovic or anything like that, or you know, it's not Aliens or, you know, stuff. But it's a very well played thriller set in the world of black market surgery, essentially, or black market medicine as a rule. You know, she does a bit of everything, or, you know, but she's mainly an anaesthetist, and she's there to support and, you know, put the subjects to sleep while somebody else does the surgery and whatever. And she's not a very ethical person to an extent, but she, you know, there comes a point where she has to make a decision. It reminded me, and it's funny enough, it's got the title of this as a tagline, but there was a short film we covered, which was an action short called Do No Harm, which was also set in the world of black market surgery. So, Do No Harm is the tagline on at least the UK release of this. It's kind of got a similar aesthetic as well. It's that darkness and the, you know, the makeshift surgical rooms and stuff, and the gangsters and things. Orla Brady as Bernadette, who's the matriarch of the sort of the gang side of things. The female characters are at the fore. There's some supporting male characters, but they're barely worth mentioning. You know, they don't do much. This is a two woman story. This is a woman trying to save her daughter, and another woman trying to save her, essentially a substitute
trying to get
a shot of redemption. It's really well done. The structure of the film is really good. So you've got the opening of the film is reflected in the conclusion of the film, which I really liked. That was very well done. Yeah, the cast is, apart from Orla Brady, who I recognised, I was trying to think of what it was, and I've looked her up. I think it's because she was in Star Trek Picard. She's the one who swears a lot in that. And obviously, you know, when you're watching Star Trek, and you're like, Jesus, why are they saying the F word every 5 seconds? She's one of those. But she's done stuff like The Foreigner as well. She's really, really good. But the lead actress, Antonia Campbell-Hughes, is very, very enigmatic. And yeah, I think it's a very, very solid, one of my favourite films of the week, I think.
It's interesting, you know, we've got this sort of heroine, this protagonist, who is very much an, you know, every woman kind of person, who finds herself having to defy this, you know, a very well-oiled criminal gang, well-oiled, well-funded criminal organisation, you know, and she's on a losing streak, basically, you know, and the film makes no qualms about how bad the situation is for her and how desperate it is and how pointless, you know, her situation is. You know, there's no sort of like big heroics here. It's like, you know, this is the sort of reality of the situation. This is how it probably would go down. To a certain degree, her solution at the end, you know, when she's sort of able to sort of turn the tables, is quite brilliant. You know, it took me a while to sort of realize what was happening, as it did everyone else, funnily enough. So that was really cool. You know, she's a vulnerable person, but resourceful and able to think on her feet, which is what you need to survive a film like this, basically. I love that ending as well, mainly because you just don't know. You just don't know which way it's going to go. So, yeah, this is a very solid, quite original sort of idea. Good, very unique setting for us. Unique sort of heroine. We don't get many sort of doctors and nurses sort of like, you know, put in these positions. I suppose the other one that comes to mind is Point Blank. That we covered recently. Oh, while we're talking about Point Blank, when we did the last show, we were insisting to Richard that Jamie Foxx was in it. We were getting confused with that other film, which is also based on a French film, which is called...
Sleepless.
Sleepless, exactly. That
was it.
Yeah, so a little bit of aside.
Yeah.
Anyway. This is a great little film, deserves to be seen. I'm going to score this one an 8 out of 10, Steve.
I'm going to go 7.
Mm-hmm. And Rich?
I'm going to go an 8 on this. And before I go, I'm just going to say the lead actress, Antonia Campbell-Hughes, I don't think I've ever seen her before, but she's got like nearly 70 credits, starting out with playing a zombie in Shaun of the Dead in 2004. She's done tons of stuff. It's unbelievable. So it's no wonder she's really good in it. She's obviously, you know, she's been honing her craft for like 15 years. So awesome. She's really good.
Absolutely. Okay, yeah. So that's 2 8s and a 7 for Black Medicine. Go check it out. Our next film then is Alone. Recently widowed Jessica is moving out of Portland to somewhere further north, and as she drives her U-Haul trailer full of furniture along the highway, she is harassed by a stranger. Despite her best efforts, she can't shake the guy and eventually finds herself in a desperate fight for her life. First thing we need to note about this film, Rich, is it's directed by John Hyams, who gave us two excellent Universal Soldier sequels.
Yes, and the Black Summer series, which I believe you're quite a fan of.
I am, yeah. My son definitely is, yeah. Yeah. So what do you make of this one?
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, when it starts off, the first act is very dual. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it was going to be a bit more like that, but it's a bit like, you know, I was saying with the birthday cake and, you know, the Scorsese influences are on the sleeve. Mm. I mean, that couldn't be more dual. Yeah. I mean, it's so well known, but
there's
you know,
there's a film we covered at the beginning of this year called Tailgate as well. Which,
yes, I was going to mention that as well. Well, I think other stuff like Let It Snow as well is also sort of relevant to the sort of stalking a young woman kind of plotline. I think this one does it really well. The so the story is broken up into chapters, and so we start out with the duel part, and then it becomes a more of a kidnapping and survival tale. It's interesting you mentioned that the synopsis mentions that she's widowed. Mm. When I was watching that, that's actually kind of a revelation that comes in towards the end of the first part, or the middle of the first act, because I thought she was leaving her husband. Mm. And then they kind of, and that's why her, she's making these calls and she doesn't want to talk to her mum and all that sort of stuff. She's at a distance with them and doesn't want to really talk about things too much. So that was quite an interesting revelation. I'm going in cold to this. I didn't know anything about it. So apart from the fact that John Hyams had directed it. So yeah, it's a stalker kind of movie. We've seen a lot of these before. There was another film called The Ranger, which I watched with, mm-hmm. Which I watched on Shudder. Which I was thinking of, because that's all set in the woods as well. This is in the woods of Oregon, encountering a psychopath. There's other stuff like The Vanishing or Breakdown or all these kind of in the middle of nowhere kind of thrillers. I watched one with Meatloaf called, I can't remember what it was called, but he was preying on women, out in the truck stops and stuff. It's very well-worn territory, but I think it works really well. What I didn't know until after watching it, we were watching the Blu-ray and I checked out one of the extra features, was that this is a remake.
Really?
Yeah, so it's a remake of a Swedish movie from 2011 called, I'm not going to try the original title, but Gone was the original translated title. Oh. And I think it's basically, very similar, basically the same plot line. I don't think they've changed too much. I think there might have been like maybe one of the character or the slight development, because what we've got here is essentially a two-hander, but then we've got a part of the story where she encounters a hunter and he becomes a third character, but very briefly. Mm-hmm. Played by a guy I'm pretty sure he was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I mean, we were talking about stuff. I'm looking him up now. He was in like the Silence of the Lambs and stuff.
Yeah, but I don't know. He was the director of the Asylum.
But maybe it wasn't Buffy the Vampire Slayer because I can't find it on his thing. But I definitely recognised him from something. So he's in there as well. The guy who's the antagonist, who's Mark Menchaca. Apologies, I don't know how to pronounce his names. He was really good. The lead actress, Jules Wilcox, very strong performance. She's very, again, like we were talking about with Black Medicine, very resourceful. She finds herself trapped in a room. It's a very believable way in which she deals with, trying to come up with an escape plan, I thought. And she's quietly observing and she finds out stuff about the psycho, basically, which is good, and it all fleshes it out. Yeah, I thought it's really good.
It is a very it's a very streamlined sort of story. There's not many sort of bells and whistles going from A to B, but it is as typical for John Hyams. It's very well paced, very very lean storytelling, as you say. You got this guy. I mean, and at first you're not sure about the guy. Is he sort of this well meaning sort of dickhead sort of thing, but it sort of goes on and on. He just won't leave her alone, and then sort of causes her to crash and that sort of thing. And then the second half of it becomes this sort of survival horror sort of scenario, which I absolutely love. I love those sort of films where someone's having to sort of battle the outside, nature and everything, as well as a human threat. Which is what we got here. I just really enjoyed it. And again, the Newmont of it, where she is able to use that information she's gleaned about him and use it to her advantage and put him in a shitty position. I thought that was really good. It's all of a sudden his dual life is being put into jeopardy, regardless of whether or not he manages to kill her or not. She's found the chink in his armor, and he's sort of this dual life that he's been leading could be in ruins. So yeah, no, it's just really, really well done.
Yeah, it's a very simple cat and mouse thriller, but very well executed. I will say there was something interesting I was feeling when I was watching when I'm watching the first act. There's two things are sort of jumping out at me. One, it's like an advert for U-Haul. And I'm thinking, why isn't U-Haul over here? Is it just because we don't have the distances? I don't know of anything like U-Haul that exists over here. Maybe it does, but
we just rent a van.
Yeah, I know there's places that do trailer rentals and stuff, but the whole concept of the U-Haul thing, I've just not come across anything like that over here. But it's very American, isn't it? We've grown up watching these movies, or you know, we've seen these movies for years, and U-Haul is just one of those brands that just keeps turning up.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the other thing was, a lot of the stuff to do with the encounters that she's having, you know, obviously this is a story about a woman in a vulnerable position. She's all on her own. She is alone, as in the title. She's got no one with her. She's got no one to turn to, really. And it's a male threat coming in. Yeah, it's the etiquette of the politeness, you know, the not wanting to express, or not even that, but even just that sort of reserve. You're kind of doing things that you don't want to do because you feel social interaction, you know, convention dictates that you should. So she's trying to respond to him and be reasonable with him, against her better judgment, you know, rather than just sort of running away or you know, just being really rude and just cutting him off or whatever. She's actually giving him a fair...
Giving him the benefit of a doubt. Because at the back of her mind, you know, as with the audience, you know, there's just that little glimmer of thinking, he could just be like a dog. And I'm being incredibly rude to him, you know. And maybe that initial incident was, you know, a mistake or, you know, on his part. And, you know, he's apologized for it and stuff, you know. But no, he just won't leave it alone. So
I will say one of the things that a slight problem that I have with films like this is the convenience of always running into the character. I mean, I know they're kind of on the same road and whatever, but it does seem a bit too convenient. Unhinged with Russell Crowe was another one that came to mind. You know, they're driving around all the city and whatever, but they just managed to keep bumping into each other. And shit, there's a point where she's getting away, and you'd think, how could he possibly find her? And he just, you know, manages to. There's a mystery about a tree that's fallen. You're never quite sure. Is that something he engineered, you know, somehow knowing that she was going to end up in there, or is it just because that's what she thinks?
Yeah.
But chances are it's something that probably just happened naturally or something, because I can't see that makes any sense in terms of predicting someone's behavior.
It's a bit contrived, but presumably that guy, Anthony Hill's character, had come in on that road. So that tree falling over must have happened after he'd parked up.
You'd have thought he'd have heard it or something. I don't know, but But I was kind of watching it, thinking, you know what, the guy character who's just referred to as the man, I believe, do find out his name.
His name's Sam.
On the credits they credit him as just the man, and I was thinking he's probably quite an experienced tracker, you know. So he's done this sort of thing. He's been out in the woods. He's got the cabin and everything. He probably knows how to find his prey quite well. So that's how I was kind of justifying it to myself, that, you know, it seemed like she, you know, she must be miles away and whatever. How could he possibly have tracked her down?
He's also adept at dealing with strangers in that situation. You know, if somebody does come across him,
well, he's quite disarming, isn't he?
Yeah. But that whole bit where, you know, when he gets out of his car and he's pretending to be on the phone to the police, and he's got, oh no, I found her, you know, being able to spin this story that, you know, she's actually I think it's his sister or something who's had a mental breakdown, you know, trying to disarm this guy. But, you know, it's just really good sort of patter that he has. So, yeah.
Another film that came to mind about his character and sort of the way he is a very different movie, but with the same kind of DNA, I guess, to the sort of character that he is, was a film called Trust with Clive Owen, which was all about grooming, basically. And the bad guy in Trust, you know, the paedophile, basically. Him and his actions and his way of being and his, you know, his disarming demeanor and the whole thing about you know, a hidden life, you know, this is like something else he does, you know, away from a real life, a normal life, you know, the dirty little secret life that he's got. That there were parallels there for me, so I think, you know, that's another film that's really well worth seeing if nobody's ever seen it. It's quite hard going, but it's that's really good as well.
Cool. Anything else on this one, Rich?
I don't think so. What do you think of the chapter headings? Do you think it was necessary, or do you think they should have just cut it out?
I think they could have cut it out. I mean, it's something that's going to come up later on as well when we review our DTV throwback this week. You know, the idea of having sort of these credits appear, or, you know, these chapters coming in. Is it really necessary? You're just drawing your attention to a certain thing. The thing is, it's also a style that he uses in Black Summer. Each episode is divided up into, I don't know, about five different parts, you know, with chapters coming up. And with that one, it's kind of useful because, you know, to have that sort of cutaway for a second, because the next scene could be something which happened earlier on in the timeline, but from a different character's perspective, which would be really confusing if he just went straight to the next scene. But if you've got that break saying this is a different chapter, you know, and you're starting off at a different place and a different, you know, sort of slightly different place on the timeline, you know, your brain can get around it a bit easier. But here, it's the most linear, streamlined thing that John Himes has probably done. How are you going to score it?
And on that note, I'm going to score it a 7 out of 10.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to join you at 7. It's very, very good, but it is very, very slight at the same time. You know, it's a breezy A to B movie, this one, with no sort of sidetracking. This is a perfectly solid 7 out of 10 from both me and Rich. Go check it out. Our next review is Blood Brothers. Two brothers' relationship strains when the younger one receives news of a strange inheritance, complicating their competition for a mysterious young woman who arrives on their island. The entire family reaches a breaking point brought about by a startling revelation about their mother's fidelity, love, friendship, and betrayal. So this is a weird one, guys. It's based on a book, a French book, a French novel called Pierre and Jean, or Jean and Pierre. And they changed the name slightly, so one's still called, I think we've got Peter and Jake as the two brothers. And their dad is played by Gordon Clapp, who used to be on NYPD Blue. It's one of the sort of secondary characters in that. This is incredibly dry period drama stuff. You know, this ain't Bridgerton, basically, is what I'm saying. Steve, did you manage to cope with this one at all?
Nope. I'm sad to say, I had to turn it off after half an hour. It was, the language was tedious. The characters were tedious. It was like Remains of the Day, where nothing that should be said is said, and it drove me insane. I mean, there's one scene where they're sat around the table eating and they're talking to you, but the language they're using is so overblown and annoying. Basically, she just needs to turn around and say, look, shut the fuck up and eat your dinner. But she doesn't... It takes her 10 sentences to say what she's saying, and yeah, I had to give up on it. So I can't give it a score because I didn't finish it, because it just didn't sit with me at all.
Rich, any redeeming features for this for you?
I liked it. I really liked it a lot. I enjoyed I quite like, I've kind of grown into period dramas and stuff with watching with my other half, and I like the aesthetic. I thought the performances were really strong. I was engaged with the, you know, it's a typical story of two brothers and, you know, the sort of power plays, you know, not power plays, but, you know, struggles between them. One brother gets handed a silver spoon, essentially, so gets his future all secured easily. The other one's a struggle. I mean, this is, they're struggling, you know, there's a struggling family, or, you know, struggle, but he's a doctor and they've got enough money. They're not poor. It's one of those kind of stories, but it's interesting. It's set on an island. Yeah, they're, it's in the context of post-Civil War. The young woman who comes to the island, I can't remember what her name is. I think it's Diane Guerrero as Lucia Childs. I might be wrong there, but yeah. I thought she was quite captivating. And yeah, the brothers, Jacqueline Bissett is in there. I thought that was, you know, she's nice. She gives it a touch of class, you know, a bit of a Julie Andrews kind of quality to proceedings. You know, it's low budget, but I think, you know, I think the costume design and the production design or locations that they've used, they've managed to get a lot for, you know, you can't compare it to British ones where, you know, we go to National Trust properties and all that kind of thing, but they've found something that looks relatively authentic, an interesting location, interesting settings and themes, for me at least, and yeah, I really enjoyed it.
I'm somewhere between the two of you on this one. I certainly admire the production, what it's going for. Like you said, the locations are good, cast is fine, didn't have any issue with that. It's just the script. I just thought this dragged out everything to the nth degree. Yeah. It really did. You know, you're struggling to sort of find out what the hell's going on at times. But it was fine. And the way it ends is just, like, bizarre. It really is. But it is true to the book. Yeah, it is actually true to the book, what actually happens. It's, you know, and you kind of feel for the doctor character because he's, you know, he's put in this sort of crappy position by his brother inheriting, you know, this fortune. And he's like, well, wait a minute, why has he inherited this fortune when I'm the older brother? You know, and all this sort of stuff going on. And then even though he's in the right, he's the one who's kind of like ostracized. By sort of what happens and or what's happened in the past, should I say. But yeah, it's just very, very strange.
It's different to basically everything else you'll see on the you know, the shelves this week and
stuff, yeah.
I think. But I think for the market, for the, you know, for the people, I mean, they're marketing it to the, like, Pride and Prejudice and Bridgerton and stuff. I mean, it's certainly not got the edge of Bridgerton, that's for sure. No. But I, you know, this is what would you say? Like,
it's kind of for, like, Emily Dickinson, sort of James,
unoffensive
kind of stuff, you know. Yeah, it's a touch of the Bronte sisters about it, you know. Yeah. But set in New England, you know, on an island just off New England, I think it's set. But yeah, it's fine for what it is. I am glad that the British version of this has dropped the Civil War part of the title.
Well, I think that's something that wasn't in the original title, that's something that's been tacked on for marketing purposes, because there's nothing to do with it. I mean, Civil War is mentioned.
Because it's set after the Civil War.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a couple of, you know, sort of consequences of people's actions.
Yes.
Coming out of it.
I think in the context of what they've used it for is that it's a civil war between the brothers. You know,
But yeah, if you look at the American cover, it's got, like, you know, infantry lined up with a cannon.
It's nothing like that. But
not at all. You're right. Yeah, in the other sense of, like, a civil sort of.
There's another poster. There's another one called Blood Brothers, where it says Blood Brothers Civil War, but it's got just her in the foreground and a bunch of the characters and the lighthouse and stuff. That's closer to what we've got in here. But the Blood Brothers seems to have been the original. What's the say Guy de Maupassant's novel? What was that called? Do you know?
It's Pierre Eugène.
Uh-huh. I was surprised because I thought it was would have been based on an American, you know, post-Civil War kind of novel.
The original book is set in Paris, apparently.
Yeah, that's quite interesting to me that they would have chosen to adapt a book and relocate it and stuff. The guy who's written and directed it, Jay Craven's got quite an extensive, you know, filmography, but I haven't seen any of it, but I presume it's probably of a similar style. Kingdom County Productions is the company, I believe, that's made it. Oh, it says here, Pierre Jean. Yeah, it's listed on the website. Mm-hmm. Saying, but for me, pleasant surprise, really, because cool. I wasn't expecting to get much out of it, and I'd comfortably watch this with my other half.
Fair enough. How are you going to score it?
I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
I'm going the opposite way for once. I'm giving it a 6 out of 10. So a 6 and a 7 for Blood Brothers. If you're a fan of things like Pride and Prejudice and things like that, this may be up your alley. Go check it out. Our next review is Trigger Point. Nicholas Shaw is an ex-government agent whose last mission ended with him being kidnapped and tortured until he gave up the names of other operatives. Now those very people have just been assassinated, and the agency he worked for turns to Shaw to help identify the killer. But who can he trust? Steve, what did you make of this one?
I really enjoyed this. I thought this is probably my film of the week. Barry Pepper is great, and he's cold. He's like cold calculating.
He's an American Daniel Craig almost.
He is. That's exactly how he is. Yeah. But you know, it's quite a generic spy story. Couple of twists and turns in there, backstabbing, double crossing, all that lot. But it just really worked. I thought it was smoothly done. The action's great, and I thought he had a really good chemistry with Colm Feore.
Yeah,
who, you know, playing his mate and stuff, and also it does start off quite slow. You've got like 10-15 minutes of build up where he's just, you know, going about his day to day life, but you know he's quite paranoid because even his front door's not a key card and, you know, stuff like that. But I really, really enjoyed this. It was just flew by, no messing, and it was, yeah, cracking.
Rich, what do you make of this?
I'll be honest, I thought it paled next to The Virtuoso, of which it shares quite a few qualities, not least the sort of small town setting for the action of the and the kind of, you know, the assassin kind of theme in this. You know, he's a retired special ops, but he's basically an assassin. He's living in his, it's, there's a John Wick element, you know, he's kind of hiding out, he's got this armory. I know in John Wick the armory is, you know, under his, in the concrete or whatever, but you know, he's got all these a cabinet of guns, and you know, he's got a security drone that he checks the perimeter and all sorts of stuff, and he lives a fairly quiet life in this. I think it's it's coastal, isn't it? It's like a coastal village, and I did think the action was reasonable, but I got a bit lost with. I wasn't hugely engaged with the plot. I think they throw lots of stuff in, and as well as, you know, crosses and double cross or whatever, but I wasn't as committed to it, as engaged with it as like I say, as like The Virtuoso, which I thought was a much stronger film with much better, a lot of aspects of that were better. This is interesting. It's a Canadian movie. Barry Pepper is Canadian, and the production's Canadian and whatever. I presume the location is Canadian. Maybe it's pretending to be America, but I think it is actually, because if he's a retired US special operative, it's probably pretending to be set in the States. Colm Feore's good. I always like seeing him. Yeah, so as I say, I thought the action was quite well handled. Barry Pepper was fine. I haven't seen him in a lot of leading roles. I mean, obviously he had that possible breakout role when he was cast as the lead in Battlefield Earth. And we all know how that turned out. Mm. And then he's done other things like Knock Around Guys and with Vin Diesel and quite a few other bits and bobs, but he's never kind of broken out. So it's interesting to see him in a lead role. I thought he was fine. I wasn't as sold on him as you guys, but I like the old lady in the bookshop and stuff like that. It's very short. It's like an hour and 15 minutes long. So I think it tries to cram in a lot of background, backstory, you know, conspiracy and whatever. There's a lot it's trying to cover. And I guess it just lost me along the way.
The Virtuoso is the last film that I was thinking of when watching this. I mean, I don't know how you managed to join those two dots.
No, I did as well.
Really?
Especially the beginning, because it was just like...
The cabin.
Yeah, you know, the cabin, the meticulousness, the this, and then it carried on and changed, but yeah, I can see where it's coming from.
No, not me.
Small town, but, people not being who you think they are. Yeah, who do you trust?
But the thing is, the Virtuoso is way out of my memory. You know, even though we only reviewed it like a month or so ago, I've forgotten about that. And, you know, it's just not one of those films that I would have instantly gone, oh, yeah, this reminds me of that. You know, The Cabin in the Woods, that sort of shit. But, I really did like this. I thought it was really well made. They put all the effort into there's no sort of hand-to-hand combat in this one. It's all gunplay, but it's well handled, it's well shot. But they've paid the extra for the proper sound effects and everything, which is as you know is one of the things I do pick up on. I just thought it worked really well. As sort of Steve mentioned, we get the hints about the character, like when he goes to the diner, he always makes sure he sits with his back to the wall, facing the door, because he doesn't want to be ambushed or surprised, that sort of thing. We find out later in the film that he's got a particular relationship to the bookstore owner, because it's a bit early on when she goes, somebody popped into the shop and was looking for you, and it all seems very innocent. And then we sort of find out later on that actually maybe it's not as innocent as he's... sort of been coming across, and he's been making a point of trying to ingratiate himself into the community, especially with the waitress, she talks incessantly, but he's very patient and just lets her, which is quite amusing. But yeah, I actually like the character. There's a bit where he goes to this nightclub with Colt Confio, and they're being interrogated by sort of the nightclub owner, and he's just sort of sitting there. He's just like really, really calm under pressure. He's the one controlling everything.
Yeah.
Is that the guy's office with the booty actually poster?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I recognised him from something. I don't remember what he's. I didn't know what. I'm sure I've seen him in something. I just couldn't think of what it was.
Yeah, I just really, really like this a lot. When I was watching it, I was thinking, this is the sort of film that Steven Seagal wants to make but can't. This is the sort of film he tries to make, but ego and sort of crappy directors and everything, he just fumbles it. This is directed by a guy called Brad Turner, who is his sort of film pedigree is doing just about every action TV series there is.
Occasional movies like Species 3. Yeah, but, very extensive TV work.
Yeah.
He's done everything.
He's done a bit of everything. Yeah.
24, notably.
Exactly, yeah. So he knows which end of the gun to point at. And I like the fact that it's open-ended a bit. I was wondering, in fact, whether or not this was, again, adapted from some sort of series of novels or something, because it leaves it quite nicely open for further adventures sort of down the line. So this was pretty solid for me. Really enjoyed it. Okay, scores on the doors then, guys. So Steve, what are you going to give Trigger Point?
An 8.
And Rich, what are you going to score this?
I'm going to give it a 6.
I'm going to join Steve on an 8. This is very good, very solid. This is the sort of thing we want out of our action. basically. So 2 8s and a 6 for Trigger Point. Go check it out. Our short shot this week is The Mandalorian, Chapter 16.5, The Hunting. As you can guess, this is a fan film set in the world of The Mandalorian, which has been a huge success on the Disney Channel. And it purports to try and sort of wedge in a bit of extra story to the ongoing saga. Rich, are you a fan of The Mandalorian?
No, I've never seen it.
Okay, so how did you get on with this short then? I mean, were you able to sort of pick up where, you know, what was going on?
I think so. I mean, I'm curious to if either of you guys know more about where perhaps this fits in. That might help a bit. But I think just looking at it from a, you know, coming at it just as a Star Wars fan film on its own merits, you know, just in isolation. In terms of the production quality and everything, and the story in the film itself was about 15 minutes long. I thought it was really good. I thought they handled the, you know, they got a nice location, well shot, costumes are really good. The fairly straightforward story that unfolds is well handled. I thought it was very solid.
Mm-hmm. Steve, I imagine you've watched the whole of The Mandalorian by now.
Yes, watched it every week when it came out. Yeah, it was okay. They you know, they definitely done the work on the production side of it. I was a little bit lacking story wise. There's not really much there.
No.
But they've done a good job on it, shall I say? You know.
So, what is this set? Is there a 16th episode that this is set after? Is that why it's called Chapter 16.5?
I'm presuming Chapter 16 was the last one in Season 2.
Right. Oh, okay.
Basically. After that, but it doesn't go into anything, really.
Mm.
It didn't really connect as such.
Okay.
To the actual storyline. It's just how they've done it, and it does work quite well.
I thought the production values were really good in this.
Especially, yeah, I've looked at some of the previous work of the director on his YouTube channel, Brad Kendrick, and it's all really, you know, it's really low budget stuff, and this they seem to have, you know, managed to get a quite a tidy budget to do it. I know they've sourced music and stuff from the movies, but in terms of the shooting of the film and the aesthetics and whatnot, it's very professional.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, the bit that surprised me actually is when you have these cutaways to the bridge of the Star Destroyer. You know, I thought that was really impressive. However they managed to do that, I thought that was really, really cool.
The director himself, I'm just looking at the notes on the video. He's only 18 years old.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, so it says, this is the result of an 18-year-old videographer / director being a lifelong fan of Star Wars with a small budget of around $4,000 and a bunch of amazing people to help him out.
Oh, yeah, you got to say
that's pretty amazing, isn't it?
I think I hate him. that is rather amazing. Although, you know, we've come across some very talented, youthful filmmakers recently as well, so but no, that's absolutely cool. I mean, I think story-wise, as we said, I mean, it's a short. Let's not lose sight of the fact that they've only got 15 minutes worth of story time. Mm-hmm. And they do sort of manage to cram in quite a few characters, you know, especially on the antagonist side with the stormtroopers and things. So I thought that all worked very well. Yeah, it's not a lot different to a lot of this sort of fan films we tend to see, you know, where they, it's more of a calling card to sort of show what they can do on a small budget rather than really, you know, push the story forward or anything. It's kind of spinning its wheels from a story point of view.
There's an Assassin's Creed short which I watched recently, which was about it was like pirates. It was a pirate set one, and I felt like it was essentially the same. Mm. You know, that in that case it was like pirates fighting on the rocks. You know, they've come in off the off the ship and stuff, and I felt that this was kind of doing a very similar kind of thing in terms of its location, characters, whatever. But you know, that's what a lot of these films are. I mean, you look at the Red Dead Redemption shorts and stuff. You know, they you know, find a nice isolated location, get some recognizable characters, have a little interplay, a little action, and you're done. And that's no bad thing.
No, not at all. And you know, if Hollywood or whatever is you know, taking its time getting these things developed, then why not, you know, do your short, get it in there, get it, you know, show Hollywood what you can do, you know, get a bit of interest. Absolutely.
So well done to young Brad Kendrick for this very long titled short film. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit of a mouthful, The Mandalorian Chapter 16.5, The Hunting. But highly recommended, I'd say. You know, especially if you're interested in Star Wars shorts, it's one of the best I've seen this year in terms of quality.
Yeah, it is a very high quality one. The costumes are superb. You know, absolutely works really well. So we don't score the shorts as usual, but we will put links to this into the footnotes below. So please, please, please check this out. It's 15 minutes long. You know, half your lunch hour. Why not munch your sandwiches while watching a bit of Star Wars? So our DTV throwback this week is Shade. A group of hustlers team up for one last job to take down the infamous Dean, a card player who has never been beaten. Stellar cast in this one, Sean. What did you make of it?
This is a cool movie, man. I'm going to be honest. This is it's not the best from Mr. Sylvester Stallone, but you know what's interesting about it is it got released around a really interesting time, not just in Stallone's career, but in the careers of all the big action guys. I mean, if you really you know, and it's one of those things, I've said it on my show before, but I didn't notice it then when it was happening, but as you look back upon it, it's almost really fascinating to look at. Okay, the late 90s to early 2000s was a really it was a real turning point in terms of not just action cinema, but it was almost kind of the beginning of the end for these big action guys. And so if you go down the list, it's really kind of amazing in a sense how Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, Jean-Claude Van Damme, all of these guys were not commanding the box office anymore, and they were all starting to, maybe not so much Schwarzenegger, because Schwarzenegger was he was going into politics. Mm-hmm. So that kind of that helped him out, but all these other guys, this is when Jean-Claude Van Damme was hitting the direct-to-video stuff. Stallone, he had three movies that he did, all three of them. It was Detox, this one, and then Avenging Angelo. Those all went direct-to-video as well. And then, you know, and so it's one of those things, I've said it on my show, it's kind of interesting. If the big guys like Stallone and Schwarzenegger, they're, you know, kind of hitting the direct-to-video market and they're, you know, no longer commanding the box office, well, then you can only imagine a guy like Dolph Lundgren, who was always kind of on the B list, if you will. It's really kind of fascinating. If the big guys above him are not getting their best work, then you can only imagine what a guy like Dolph was getting, or what a guy like Steven Seagal was getting. And so if you look at their films, and it's again, I find this pretty fascinating, but if you look at Dolph's career, the late 90s, early 2000s, that's the period where I think he put in probably some of the worst films in his entire CV. And it really makes sense now when you look at it.
Mm. Okay, so the film itself, we've got a bunch of grifters here. Gabriel Byrne, Stuart Townsend, Thandie Newton are the sort of the integral parts of this. And it is sort of really interesting to sort of see the these characters, you know, the sort of the mechanics and the dynamics of them. Steve, what did you make of Shade? Had you even heard of this film before? This had not been on my radar at all until Rich mentioned it.
No, never heard of it at all. Not seen anything. Completely passed me by. But it was enjoyable. It was kind of like Ocean's 11, but without the bank heist, you know, it's all based on the card table. And found it really good. I thought the performances were pretty stellar, to be fair. I mean, Stallone, he's just oozing charm and class in this one. He really does lay it thick on the table. And especially with, like, you know, the scenes with Melanie Griffith as well. They were really, really good. Also, Jamie Foxx as well. Young Jamie Foxx, which was quite surprising. He's only in it for half the film, really. But no, it's just really slick, enjoyable, classy, quite funny as well. Decent card movie.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if it was the subject matter that sort of kept it under the radar. I mean, you know, the sort of the grifter kind of thing, or the, you know, the gam, you know, that sort of gambling thing. I don't think it sort of quite hit the zeitgeist at the time. You know, the Matt Damon film Rounders with Edward Norton, that didn't do particularly well, even though I thought it was really good. It
became a cult hit.
Yeah.
I mean, we should also say, Rounders, sorry to cut you off there, but I mean, Rounders, yeah, that one wasn't a huge hit when it came out, you know, at the box office, but it has gone down, especially in later years, as being like a real cult classic. Like that particular film is studied and analyzed by, you know, poker fanatics and, you know, just average poker players. And I mean, yeah, you guys said it. I mean, that's the kind of unfortunate thing about this film is it has an amazing cast. I mean, obviously Stallone is not at center stage of the film, which I think was actually kind of a really cool decision on his behalf for him to take this small little role, but it's an awesome supporting cast, but just overall ensemble cast that has a lot of really cool performances, and no one is phoning it in. No one is phoning it in. They're giving it all. The one thing that I took away from it that I thought was funny is Stuart Townsend is the lead. So this was obviously made at a time when people thought that Stuart Townsend was going to be the next big thing. That didn't happen.
But he's quite low key in the center in this as well. You know, it's not a flashy performance from him. He is the sort of slightly more sympathetic character, I guess, out of all of them. So, Rich, over to you. I mean, had you seen this before?
Yeah, I saw it when it came out. It was very low key.
But you were the one. You were the one person.
Well, basically, yeah, it was High Flyers who picked it up in the end for the UK release, and you know they don't do any advertising or anything apart from like putting a trailer on another release. That's about all you're going to get, and the film itself probably sank without much of a much notice. But yeah, the cast is really good. I'm not so struck on Stuart Townsend again, like Sean was saying, he got that kind of never happened, you know. He did the Anne Rice
Queen of the Damned.
And obviously he'd done Shooting Fish and different things. But this was kind of, I think I haven't. I should really look up at what he's done after this. But I don't think he's. Whereas on the other hand, you've got Jamie Foxx, who's clearly got star potential. You know, and he's sort of ascended and become most successful out of them all. Although Gabriel Byrne, obviously very successful actor, still doing really well, and Tandy Newton as well. But we've also got people like Bo Hopkins in a supporting role. The film is coming out 2 years after Ocean's 11, which does not work in its favour. I think that's the thing. You know, everyone was going to compare it to that. It can't reach the heights of that. You know, Stallone is in there. He's a little bit of a George Clooney in this. But, you know, the budget is much lower. It's very much, you know, going from set to set. There's not any grand set pieces or anything. It's closer to the card game in Casino Royale than anything else.
Do you think people would have found it difficult to follow the actual sort of grifts they're doing, sort of, you know, the con they do to their partner at the beginning, you know, that sort of thing? Do you think people might have been a bit sort of like, oh, hang on, what's happened exactly?
Well, I think it's quite complexly structured. Whether that always works or I don't know. I think some bits work better than others.
There's a lot of overlay, isn't there? So like, we'll get to a point. Someone will say something, and then it'll jump back 5 minutes and show you something from a different perspective.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not always clearly signposted.
Well, it's not as convoluted as it could be. I mean, I don't know if you guys saw it, but Guy Ritchie and Jason Statham did the film Revolver. You know, kind of has some similar themes, and that one is almost in love with itself over the fact of how deliberately confusing it is being. You know what I mean? This one, I feel like it's obviously because it's a movie about poker playing. So obviously there's going to be some some wild cards, if you will, and some, you know, people who are playing multiple sides and everything. But it spells it out to where, in my opinion, the first time I viewed this, a lot of those turns, a lot of those twists kind of took me by surprise. And you know what I mean? Like they weren't overly confusing, but they came in at just the right angle for me. And even if you're not a big poker player, I think you're still going to find something with this film that is enjoyable.
I'll tell you what I like. Yeah. It starts out with the RKO Pictures logo, yeah, which automatically gives it a retro kind of feel, because RKO Pictures originally went back bankrupt like donkeys years ago. So I don't know how they kind of managed to resurrect the not necessarily the studio, but you know, they managed to bring it back as a brand or as a company for at least a limited time. I think they might have done one or two other films around this time. But it's got an old fashioned kind of feel to it. And I think the film itself is kind of coming off the back of Ocean's 11, but it's much more based on The Sting. You know, it's got that kind of, I mean, even the ending and stuff it seems to be clearly inspired by The Sting, which was from 1973.
Yeah.
And Robert Redford and that, but it's got this kind of old style quality to it. And although Sylvester Stallone is not the main character, he is introduced as a very key character, and he's the first character we see in the story.
Yeah,
and I think they did a really good job with casting the young Dean Stevens. They did a really good job with casting him, because you recognize that he is supposed to be the Sylvester Stallone character. I feel. I think he's got a good look, and you know, they don't try to imitate the voice too much, but you know, they try it a little bit. I mean, I saw the latest Fast and Furious movie where they do flashbacks to a young Dominic Toretto, and I think the guy here playing the young Stallone is a much better match than the guy playing the young Vin Diesel in F9. So I think his name was Jason Ciboney or Ciboney, but anyway, so I thought he did a good job, and then it kind of, so they establish his character. He's the main guy that they're going to try and take down, apparently. Then they introduce all the other characters. There's lots of, you know, cross and double cross and lots of other characters being introduced. We've got Roger Guevara Smith, who we watched in the Mercenary for Justice with Steven Seagal. He's kind of a bit similar to that character in this, you know, he's a bit of a low life. But his guy who he works with, his enforcer, is B Real from Cypress Hill.
Be Real. I was hoping someone was going to mention that, or else I was going to throw it out there. Yeah, Be Real shows up as the heavy.
As the heavy, yeah. Mostly doesn't really say anything, just kind of stands there for the most part.
It does have a pretty decent little shootout in the middle of the film as well, featuring
Gabriel
and the other guy.
That's kind of the big action beat, really. There's not really any more action apart from that.
But they handled it really well. You know, it was some decent sort of clean action, sort of, you know, decent editing. So I was quite happy with that little sequence.
And quite fun, where he's like getting hold of the gun and trying to fire it. Then, oh, there's nothing in it. I better get down, jumping out of the way and all that sort of stuff.
It's really cool. Yeah.
And yeah, Melanie Griffith is in there, but she doesn't get a huge amount to do in this, unfortunately. I think she's like the love interest to sort of anchor the Dean's character, but there's not really anything for her to do in it. And I also want to mention, in terms talking about the cast, Michael Dorn, who was
Worf,
Worf from Star Trek: The Next Generation. Yeah, he turns up at the card game.
Yep. That, again, doesn't do much, but you know, an interesting presence around that table. This is just really, really enjoyable, and it's interesting to sort of, you know, discover these films. We consider ourselves to be film aficionados, and yet something with a cast like this can still just slip us by, you know, until the right moment, which is really, really cool.
It opens with a really nice tracking shot, which you know, it seems like a one shot thing going into the club and whatever. I mean, that not the initial opening necessarily, but you know, when you're introducing Gabriel Byrne's character.
That tracking shot was really cool. I wasn't sure whether or not he actually owned that club, you know, because he seemed to know everyone. And everyone knows him, sort of thing. And you know, he's friends with everyone, sort of thing. There's another really good, you know, we've been talking about drone shots and things like that recently, and there's a really good one sort of late on where the drone is actually sort of pulling away from the house or the hotel. You know, it's the like opposite zoom shot basically, which looked really really good. I must admit, I thought that was, you know, quite unusual.
Now, one thing that I did find a bit complicated, or not complicated, a bit confusing, was you got the Dean, who is like the ultimate player. Everyone idolizes him, you know, they all want to get down and sit, play at the table with him.
Yeah.
But they all know he's a cheater. So where's the? I mean, I know he's a good cheater, but why would you want to sit down and play with the best cheater? You know, it's like, I didn't understand that at all.
Probably because you're a cheater as well.
Yeah, but do you think other people who he plays with, do they know?
It's a matter of pride. Like, okay, it's a table full of cheaters. Who in the end is going to prevail as being the best?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, I see that.
Can we just say real quick, just how, I mean, we kind of danced around it, but how wonderful I think Sylvester Stallone is in this role.
Yeah.
I mean, because if you kind of want to go backwards a bit and kind of look at, again, kind of echoing what I said earlier, but if you look at Stallone's career when this came out, well, excuse me, it came out in 2003, 2004, but if you look at Stallone's career around this period, okay, he was falling on some pretty hard times. I mean, he wasn't doing much at the box office anymore. His films, Get Carter and Driven, those floundered. So I think it was a really wise move on his behalf for him to take on the role, take on, you know, a small little supporting role like this, where maybe he's not playing like a mafia boss or whatever, but where he's playing like, you know, this this kind of boogeyman of the card table, if you will, that everyone is afraid of. And I think that was, if we're gonna have Stallone take a small little supporting role, then this is the film that I would want him to do it in. And the other thing, I want to throw it out there real quick. I mean, Richard, you said it already regarding Ocean's 11. I would much rather go back and watch this particular film again, or I'd much rather see a sequel to this film than any of those Ocean's 11 films. Those Ocean's films, I feel, in my opinion, I've never liked them, because the thing with those films is, yeah, those ones, they all have these ensemble casts of, like, you know, tons of, you know, all these mainstream actors. But it's one of those things where you can tell that they're all having just such a fun time on set, and that fun never translates on, you know what I mean? Like, I'm just watching it and I'm bored, as opposed to this one, like, I'm having fun with it.
Yeah, the second one in particular, that was just, like, so indulgent.
Yeah, it was pretty insufferable, that one. I actually really like number one and number three.
Horses for courses. The opening credits for this really set the standard as well. You know, the whole thing with the cards, it wasn't just like names against a black background sort of thing. They actually put a lot of effort into it, which I thought was really, really good.
Yeah, they do some, they've got close-up magic, haven't they? Basically, close-up card dealing and stuff.
Which I think brings us on to the writer-director of this film, which is Damien Neeman. This is his only film that's actually produced. I think he was attached to a couple of others. I don't think they actually got any traction. But his background, I think, is he is a magician. He's sort of slated kind of guy.
Okay.
It's obviously a passion project for him. You know,
I will say on the subject of that, I thought Stuart Townsend handled the cards really well. Because you know, they're doing some shots where they're not just cutting to close ups, so he's moving the cards, he's swiping them around, you know, playing with the deck, and you know, that's not easy stuff. And I'm presuming he probably put a lot of he put a lot into learning how to do that for the film. I would expect.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I mean, it's a shame that this is Damien's only film today. I mean, I think he handles this very well. He handles the material very well. It would have been interesting to sort of see him get another project going, I think.
Well, you know, this film also does really well that I really like is, you know, I mean, we see this a lot. I'm sure you guys have seen it a lot in direct-to-video films, but it does that old trick of where the frame will freeze and then, like, the character's name will fly onto the screen. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about? Like,
yeah.
And,
Yeah, this gets away with it because it is from 2003.
This gets away with it. Yeah, it gets away with it because it's from 2003. And also because I feel like, considering the nature and the thematic elements of the film, with it being a poker game, because, I mean, if you think about it, a lot of the audience is going to come in seeing this has probably never sat down and played a game of poker. So they may not have any kind of knowledge about that world, if you will. But I think this film gets away with it and does it well, to where, okay, you know, the camera will freeze and then you have that person's face on the screen, and then the mechanic flies in like a really kind of flashy font, or the wheel man, or whatever it may be. Here, I think it works, as opposed to within the past 10 years, films that have been doing this, it's almost kind of exposition shorthand, to where I feel like it, you know, it gets thrown in there because the writers and everyone, they just simply do not want to, you know, spend 30 seconds of dialogue time or whatever it may be, letting you know that this person is bad or whatever it may be.
Or it's just they're just trying to be trendy, basically. You know, like Polar and that Luke Goss film, Payday, I think, did it, didn't it?
Yep,
a lot of them do it. It's all, you know, STEM, you know, Guy Ritchie used to do it a lot and stuff, I think.
At least it's not in media res. So
yeah, we don't really get any in media res or anything here, although you know, you got your flash forwards and your flashbacks and stuff. One little thing that's quite interesting is that the film starts with this very, you know, what's it called? Very small time grift that Tandy Newton and Gabriel Byrne are doing, which is basically just to rip someone off for like a few hundred dollars. And then you'll get introduced to Gabriel Byrne. He's trying to do this big job and everything. And he's sort of presenting himself as, you know, like quite a successful guy who's, you know, got all this money and, you know, he's trying to do the big time. But that scene at the beginning sets it up, establishing that he's trying to play with the big boys. He's actually, you know, hand to mouthing it, basically.
Yeah. That was ridiculous. We've got $300.
Yeah, but again, that's ripped off from Zombieland. Or Zombieland ripped it off.
All right.
Because that's what Emma Stone and Abigail Breslin's character are doing in Zombieland.
It's probably quite a well-worn, grift. I mean, Zombieland was 2009, so it's possible that they've, but it's probably one of those things.
You know, you've got that bit, and you've also got, like, you know, the titles coming in and stuff like that. And that's what it got me thinking of in them parts.
All right. Anything else, guys, for Shade?
I'm just passing mention that Hal Holbrook is also in it.
He is. He gets a good scene, actually. I like that. I like that sort of acerbic conversation he has with Gabriel Byrne's character. You know,
I think the script's really good.
Yeah, the script was very, very well written. Yeah, all around.
What do you think about Sylvester Stallone's grey? Because you don't often see him grey, and I don't know if that was natural grey or whether they'd affected it or something. But it's very particular.
It is. It's sort of almost Richard Gere-ish, isn't it? Basically,
that's what was making me think they're kind of trying to Clooney him. You know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good point, actually. Trying to give him that sort of mature,
savoir faire, you know. Yeah, Stallone, he wasn't fully gray yet, like he is now. He's still, you know, his hair was still dark. So I don't know. It kind of did kind of throw me off. I mean, funny you mentioned it, actually, because I remember when this film was in production, I was following it because I was, you know, the next Stallone movie, what's going on? And when they released the first photo of him, I'll never forget, actually, but when I first saw the first production still of him sitting at a card table with that gray hair, I remember thinking, oh boy, what is this area?
Okay, so that is Shade. It's available on Amazon Prime. We don't score the DTV throwbacks, but we certainly recommend them, and we definitely recommend this. It's a great little film if you like things like The Sting, or even Rounders, like we mentioned. There's a lot going on here. Even if you're a fan of Guy Ritchie, you know, like Revolver, we mentioned. What's the other one he did with, what's his name? Jared Butler.
Rock and Roller.
Rock and Roller.
Rock and Roller.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously you got the Thandie Newton connection there, but I did think about that a couple of times while watching it. So, lots to recommend here, especially the cast. The cast is superb. And that's the end of this week's show. So thank you to Sean for joining us this evening.
Hey, thank you for the invite. It's always a pleasure talking with you guys and and getting the invite. So thank you.
No problem at all. If you like what we're doing here, check us out on Facebook and Twitter at the DTV Digest. We also have a sister show where we look at the just a short films called The Short Shots. So thanks to Rich and Steve for joining me as well.
Always a pleasure.
And to everyone out there, thank you for listening and tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.